good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Michael Foolilove, the Executive Director of the Institute. Welcome to our first Sydney event for 2018 and Happy New Year. We're going to examine today how happy the new year may actually be. I'll be moderating this panel discussion with my Institute colleagues on the big issues that will affect Australia and the world in the year ahead. We know, looking ahead, we can see some milestones already for the year. We know there'll be midterm elections, of course, in the United States, and perhaps Mr. Trump's speech yesterday was the first speech in those in the campaign for the midterms. There'll be further Brexit negotiations. There'll be elections in Pakistan, Russia, and Italy. I think Mr. Putin, we can safely say, is safe. If you'd told me 5 years ago that Silvio Berlusconi would have a chance at re-election in 2018, I wouldn't have believed you. I would have said he'd had one too many bunga bunga parties for that, but that apparently is a realistic prospect. There's potential for conflict on the Korean Peninsula, and in his address yesterday, President Trump had some harsh words for North Korea. But on the other hand, we'll see the two Koreas march together into the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics in Pyeongchang. We'll see a combined South and North Korean women's hockey team take to the ice. Ewan might confirm it or not, but I suspect it's probably the first time that two countries that are technically at war have formed a combined Olympic team. Closer to home, Fiji and Solomon Islands will go to the polls, while New Caledonia will vote in a referendum on independence. On a global level, the major economies are growing, but ironically, many world leaders, increasing number of world leaders, don't believe in free trade. Freedom House argues that democracy is in crisis, with a decade-long trend of more countries becoming less democratic each year, and cracks continue to appear in the facade of the liberal international order. So it promises to be a very big year. We have an outstanding panel of Institute experts. I know there are a lot of people on the stage. We're just fitting in, and John Edwards and I are going to have to make sure that we don't lean out on our chairs, but that's because we have a lot of expertise to share at the Institute. Joining me today from the far left, John Edwards, our non-resident fellow on economics. Next is Alex Oliver, our deputy research director, Anthony Bubalo, our research director, Ewan Graham, our director for international security. Let me begin by giving, and the way I'll do it, I'm going to ask each of the panel a sort of a general question and do some follow-ups, and then halfway through I'm going to allow everyone in the audience to have an opportunity to ask questions. So please start thinking now, because we like to get a good cross-section from all parts of the room in terms of questions. So let me start with just a softball, an opening ball that an English bowler would bounce in the Ashes series. What do you think? Let me start at your end, John. What do you think will be, what's the biggest likely development in 2018 in the economic sphere? What should we be looking out for?
Well, I think the biggest thing, far and away, is that we are in a, if not coordinated, then very widespread global economic upswing. It's been going on actually for a while. Europe turned around a while ago. China's been growing well. The US is actually in the ninth year now of an upswing. But I think we're only now beginning to recognise that how widespread this upswing is. And certainly the IMF has increased its global growth forecasts for 2018. So I think that's the most important thing that's happening through 2018. And then we've got two question marks over it. One is the pace of monetary tightening by global central banks, and the other is what happens with the US and China in respect of trade and other economic issues.
Let me ask you one follow-up. Mr. Trump was quick to take credit in the State of the Union for economic growth in the United States, and of course he's constantly banging on about stock market. Of course, he's not Robinson Crusoe as a politician in taking credit for positive economic news. But how much credit do we owe Mr. Trump, do you think, for the condition of the US economy?
Zero, I think. Zero. This is all things that we spoke about last year and probably the year before, as I made the point that this is an upswing that's in its ninth year in the US. It hasn't changed substantially over the course of 2017. It's just kept going to the extent that anything associated with Trump will have an impact. It will be this year through the corporate income tax cuts, and the principal impact is through capital spending, where the package that was passed by Congress encourages businesses to bring forward capital spending to this year and next at the expense of later years. But that means we'll have another, one or two, 0.2 or 0.1 on US growth this year. That I would say is the main effect.
What about the stock market? What do you attribute that to?
Well, this is, it's again, the seventh, eighth year of US stock market. You might call it a boom. It continued through 2017. It's quite elevated. The price equity ratio is a little bit stressed, so it's not clear how much further it has to run, but I don't think you can attribute it to Trump.
Okay. Alex, what would you nominate? What should we watch?
John mentioned the trade issues between the US and China, or with US and China, but for me the US and China question is a bit more through the lens of public opinion, and that is, for how long can Australia maintain this balancing act between China and the US? On one hand, its economic relationship, and on the other hand, the security relationship. And the developments of last year, the evidence of Chinese influence in Australian politics on Australian campuses, might develop during the year into and have some impact on that balance of whether Australians think it is possible to maintain this delicate act and have a good relationship with China and the United States at the same time. And that's certainly something we'll be looking at in our March fieldwork for our annual poll.
What about in our immediate region, Alex, in the Pacific? What should we be looking for?
Well, as you mentioned, the elections. So it's election season in the Pacific, and there's the Fiji elections, the Cook Island elections, and the Solomons elections. And Fiji will be quite interesting because it's only the second election held since the return to democracy after 8 years of military rule, but democracy in quotation marks there. The New Caledonia referendum will be very interesting. Could this be, the New Pacific's version of a Frexit? The accord in 1998 stipulated that New Caledonia should have a referendum on self-rule by the end of 2018 at the latest, but there's no date set yet. And the other big development in the region will be APEC in PNG. So this is a high-risk event for Papua New Guinea. It really puts it in the spotlight. Papua New Guinea's economy is under great strain. It's had many years of economic growth through the LNG project, but that growth is now being tested. There are some budget issues, as there's continuous deficits, consecutive deficits, and PNG really needs to pull this off, or it could be a very difficult year for it. Now, the Australian government and New Zealand governments are putting quite a lot of support behind it to help PNG make that event work, but it obviously is a very big event for the Pacific.
Anthony, on the other side of the world, the Middle East, nothing slows down much in the Middle East.
Nothing happening there.
What should we focus on?
Look, it's a difficult one because there are so many candidates for things to focus on, and it's always the case. You pick one thing to focus on, it's the thing that comes from left field that blindsides you in the Middle East that's often the bigger event. But, we... In the West, we tend to have a focus on the big geopolitical issues in the region, the proxy wars and the real wars that are occurring between states and the competition that's occurring between them. But actually, what I'm looking at is what's happening within states in the region. I think there's some really important things that are often being missed by the mainstream media, and looking at the changes that are taking place within Middle Eastern societies. There's this tendency to kind of write off that whole period of the Arab uprisings and other uprisings that happened in the region. But those processes haven't ended. They've changed and they continue. There's also some big national reforms going on, and the best example of that, the one I'm watching most closely, is in Saudi Arabia, where you have a young 30-something crown prince who is not so much trying to reform Saudi Arabia as re-engineer it. You know, he's talking about turning it into a country that is less dependent on oil income because oil income is declining, and more dependent on its investments around the world, turning it into an investment powerhouse. He's re-engineering Saudi society by, you know, fairly soon you'll soon be able to go to the movies in Saudi Arabia. You'll be able to you can already go to. And this is the big thing is the kind of the lifting of restrictions on women driving. And in Jeddah a few weeks ago, they had the first car show for women to buy cars. There are darker sides to this as well. At the end of last year, MBS invited a number of his fellow princes and some prominent business people in the kingdom to the Ritz-Carlton Hotel, and then kept them there. A few of them have ended up in jail. And this is part of both an anti-corruption drive, but also an effort to really centralize power. So he sees himself, you know, he's doing something that other Middle Eastern leaders have done before, which is centralize power and then try and remake the place. Why it's important is, firstly, because if he succeeds, Saudi Arabia is an important country in the region and globally. But also what it tells us is that there is recognition amongst leaders in the region that all the things that caused the Arab uprisings haven't been resolved. That the systems that most of them preside over are broken and are continuing to decay. And unless they are able to reform or in his cases, re-engineer these systems, they may in some cases continue to decay and collapse.
There've also been, as you say, some darker outflows of MBS's behaviour. He's leading a number of Saudi efforts that are being criticised on human rights grounds and other reasons. He's spending a lot of money. He's also been accused of interfering in Lebanese politics with negative repercussions, not only for Lebanon but probably for Saudi's image. So, when you know, net-net, are you more positive about MBS as a young reformer who may turn Saudi around, or are you more concerned about the implications of having a young, headstrong leader who is casting aside the sort of conventions of how Saudi politics normally operates?
I'm more concerned because I think certainly in terms of external policy and the new assertiveness that MBS has introduced into Saudi foreign policy, he's doing a lot of damage. The war in Yemen that he launched because of fears that Yemen was about to become another outpost of Iranian influence in the region has been a disaster. Has been a disaster in terms of its own objectives. It's been a disaster for ordinary Yemenis. If it wasn't for the fact that we had another disaster in Syria and other disasters around the region, Yemen would really be preoccupying people. I mean, levels of disease, starvation are levels that we haven't seen before in the region or indeed around the world. There are other things he's done that have been entirely counterproductive. Having said that, within Saudi Arabia, amongst young people, he does seem to be popular because he's breaking some of those old rules about how Saudi Arabia is governed. And some of those rules, and particularly the emphasis was placed on consensus within the royal family, which meant that, you know, change really happened at a glacial pace. And in Saudi Arabia, most of the population is under the age of 29. So in that sense, the sense that he's moving is still very positive.
Ewan, what about in Northeast Asia? What about on the Korean Peninsula? Do you feel more positive or more negative when you look ahead at 2018?
I think the North Korean melodrama will remain centre stage, even though we're in a lull at the moment. And that lull is shaped by the positive development of having the two Koreas talking to each other. And as you mentioned up front, the formation of a joint Olympic team and a performance. So literally it's coming together in dramatic fashion in the coming weeks. But I don't see any fundamental resolution of that. I think rather what's happened is the US has sort of given pause, allowed the South Koreans that time to try and explore the goodwill around the Olympics to see if there's anything substantive by way of a North Korean negotiation or movement on the nuclear front. But I think that that hope will probably be unfortunately short-lived, and we will be back into testing season, literally, come the spring, if not before. And I think the North Koreans very much like that status of being at the front of the melodrama. It suits them in many ways, and I think they will continue to exploit that. However, I think, is that the biggest strategic story of the year? Perhaps not. One of the ways in which North Korea helps China is the noise that it creates also distracts the United States. It distracts the United States from, I think, the continuing bigger underlying longer-term implication of China becoming, I think, progressively more dominant within this region. One prediction I'll make up front is that we may see the first deployment of combat aircraft to the Spratly Islands in the South China Sea, where China has developed artificial facilities this year. Even though it will continue to engage the ASEAN countries diplomatically in a form of a code of conduct that probably is not much more than window dressing. But I think that because of that distraction value of North Korea, we'll also see the other fault lines. We shouldn't take our eyes off the other long-standing point of tension, which is the cross-strait relationship between Taiwan and China, where there's been, I think, gathering pressure from the Chinese side no give, I think, in terms of, again, the fundamentals there. Whether that flash is hot in 2018, I think, is less certain, but that's certainly a trend line to watch.
Going back to North Korea, how do you think US policy will develop on North Korea? I mean, there feels like there's a bit of a drumbeat towards some sort of limited military action by the United States. At least that's what a lot of analysts are pointing at. There was some criticism about of North Korea by President Trump in the State of the Union, although, as you said on Twitter, it wasn't personalised at Kim Jong-un. We've also had the very interesting story that Victor Cha, who was almost officially appointed as Mr. Trump's ambassador to South Korea, has been withdrawn. That nomination has been withdrawn in part because we're led to believe because Mr. Cha made some sceptical comments about that kind of military action during the process, and that led to the White House stopping returning his phone calls. On the other hand, we've noted over the last year that Mr. Trump talks a big game, but he's actually fairly cautious to date in terms of military action. And even when he's undertaken it, as he did in the Middle East, for the most part, it's been limited and not highly risky action. So, what do you think? Do you think he's squaring for a fight, or is this all part of the negotiation?
It may be more than a bluff. But it's a very high-risk bluff if there is a genuine view in the White House that preventive strikes remain an option. I don't think there is a scenario under which military action that's initiated by the United States against North Korea it remains limited, because the logic for North Korea to retaliate, I think, will be so strong that it would indeed be too risky, I think, to pursue that option. Even though there are no other good options for the United States, I suspect that we'll also see those countervailing voices within the administration, chiefly Defense Secretary Mattis, continuing, I think, behind the scenes to take a more cautious line. And the very difficult thing to unpick is to what extent this is operating at a psychological level in which there are clearly two public elements to Mr. Trump's approach to North Korea. On the one hand, it's maximum pressure and keeping the military option on the table, but on the other, there's also the sit down and want to talk and prepared to to meet Kim Jong-un, which is a recurrent theme. And the two are linked in the hope that that pressure strategy will eventually deliver North Korea to the table in a meaningful sense. But I'm skeptical that that the United States would take the risk of a preventive strike, because I think there are enough councils within the administration that make exactly that point, that this is not Syria, and that a scenario for limited action, if it's initiated by the United States, would almost certainly meet a response from North Korea. And then we go up the chain of escalation, potentially, including nuclear conflict.
I might ask some further Trump questions of my colleagues, seeing as everybody likes to hear about Mr. Trump. Anthony, what about Mr. Trump's posture in the Middle East? What have been his successes over the last year? For example, how much credit should we give him for the degradation of Islamic State? How do you judge the way he's approaching the Iran issue? And finally, is there any hope now on the Israel-Palestinian front after his recent announcement on Jerusalem?
Look, on Islamic State, I think you can say that, that under the Trump administration, and I think this is more the work of Secretary of Defense Mattis than it is specifically of Trump, there has been a little intensification or acceleration of the military effort on the ground, but I think more or less the strategy was set under the Obama administration. It was a fairly limited strategy to conduct an air campaign and introduce some particularly special force elements on the ground to destroy Islamic State's territorial hold over its caliphate that stretched from northern Syria into Iraq. They identified that strategy a little bit, but I think in the end the result would have been the same. On Iran, it's very clear there is a different strategy. The Obama administration's strategy was about striking a deal with the Iranians over the Iranian nuclear program, which is what they did. President Trump has been very, very critical of that program, of that deal. In fact, he was critical in the State of the Union address. He hasn't done that much to actually unwind it, and I think that reflects the professional opinion that, you know, okay, it may not be a perfect deal, but you know, what are the alternatives? However, I think that the risks are growing that the US and Iranians may come to blows somewhere in the region, whether it's in the Persian Gulf or in some of these areas where Iran has expanded its influence in Syria or in Iraq or even in Yemen, simply because the general posture in the administration as a whole, not just Trump, but also I think, again, with Secretary of Defense Mattis, is that the general view is that too much was sacrificed to get a nuclear deal with it in terms of holding back Iran's expanding interest in the region. And Iran certainly has profited from the turmoil in the region, particularly by, you know, through its backing of the Syrian regime of Bashar al-Assad, and essentially defeating the insurgency there, but also expanding Iran's influence, a bit of meddling in Yemen, the expanding in Iraq as well. So I think we are likely to see over the next year more of a pushback against that, which may increase the chances of you know, some direct kind of confrontation. I'm not talking all out war or invasion, but where you know incidents will happen, you know, between naval vessels in the Persian Gulf and American counterparts. In terms of the Israeli-Palestinian peace process, I mean, Trump ended the year last year saying that recognizing Jerusalem as the Israeli capital. Now, Trump has, in that recognition, hasn't really changed all that much. It's a recognition of the reality on the ground. It's a recognition of the Jewish people's long and deep historical ties to Jerusalem, and it doesn't actually preclude one day a deal being made over the Jerusalem where the Palestinians do establish in some part of Jerusalem, the capital of the future state. But what it did was undo what seemed to be a lot of good work that was being done behind the scenes to try and get the two sides back to the negotiating table. Now, we don't know how successful that was, but, you know, from some reports, it was certainly up until that point, the administration had a fairly positive relationship with the Palestinians. That is now gone. Abu Mazen, the Palestinian leader, made a very incendiary speech to the Palestinian Central Committee a few weeks ago, where, you know, he's basically said, we are no longer interested in the United States as a partner in brokering a solution. Trump is, and there's a bit of retaliation going on now. The US has suspended some funding to UNRWA, the UN organization that's charged with looking after Palestinian refugees. So it's very hard to see now Trump achieving his own declared aim of striking the ultimate deal.
John, one of Mr. Trump's declared aims during the presidential campaign was getting a better deal for the United States in its trade, especially with China. And he made a lot of incendiary comments during the campaign to that effect. We haven't seen too much of that. But what do you think? But we are hearing behind the scenes that that the administration is looking to toughen up its stance on China on economic issues as well as on some security issues potentially. What do you think is the likelihood of more assertive economic action on the part of the United States against China? What would a trade war between the United States and China look like? What would the effect be on a country such as Australia?
Well, I think this is an issue on which we ought to have a little sympathy with Mr. Trump, because he did, as you suggest, he made a huge thing of this in the election campaign. It's a great populist issue, but actually in office it's very hard to think your way around it or through it, as he is discovering. His rhetoric was grounded in a period in which the US current account deficit was huge. It was 5% of GDP. And the corresponding Chinese current account surplus was huge, 10% of GDP. And that was 10 years ago. But that's over. The Chinese current account surplus is now a fifth of what it was a decade ago. And the US current account deficit's half. It's no longer such an issue. The US had a had a trade deficit of 1.7% of its GDP with China 10 years ago. It's the same today. It hasn't changed. It hasn't got worse. It hasn't got better. But over that period, you don't encounter this number very often. Over that period, it's true that Chinese exports to the US have gone up 60%, which is quite a lot. But US exports to China have gone up by twice as much, twice as fast as Chinese exports to the US. So the situation is not as, the circumstances are not as no longer in accord with the kind of populist belief on which he was working. Now, the other big issue I think is very difficult to deal with is the distinction between an economic contest and a security contest. In a security contest, there's no doubt whatever that the US is a predominant power technologically in terms of forces deployed and, very importantly, in terms of the allies it can command. On a security issue, we are an ally of the US, as Korea is, Japan is, Europe is, Germany is. But on an economic issue, the US itself is no longer, in relation to China, clearly predominant. At the time China joined the WTO in 2001, its economic size was one-tenth of the US. It's now two-thirds, and that's just on US dollars in terms of IMF calculations. China as an economy is really bigger. Well, this is a big distinction. You're taking on not some little country, but somebody as big as you are. And you're doing it without allies, we're not going to be there. Germany's not going to be there. Japan's not going to be there. Korea's not going to be there. Because they all have, as we do, generally very satisfactory trading relationships with China and investment relationships. It's Japan's biggest partner. It accounts for a third of our exports. We're not going to get into a fight with China on the US behalf. And the other puzzling thing is if Trump wanted to initiate a trade war, it would have some kind of objective. You would be reading accounts about how the US was insisting that China remove the impediments to this or the impediments of that export. And you can leaf through the recent report of the US Trade Representative and not actually much there about impediments in China to US exports to China. There's a little bit in agriculture, a little bit here and there, but it's not very big. There doesn't seem to be a plan that would say, well, you know, as a consequence of the trade war, we'll reach an agreement and our exports to China will be materially better. The area in which the US has a comparative advantage is in services. And it's true that China is quite restrictive on services. But services requires usually, you know, a right of establishment which is related to investment. You usually, if you're going to be serious about services, you need to have an investment agreement, which was what was the Obama administration was negotiating. Well, the Trump administration has not continued those negotiations. Partly, I think, because for the US to invest more in China, it needs to reach an agreement in which China could invest more in the US, which is not part of the Trump White House story at all. So, Michael, I have to say, first of all, we know a trade war between the two biggest economies in the world, were it to come to that, it would be devastating for them and for everybody else. So devastating, I can't contemplate that it could occur. But what really puzzles me is I can't figure out how Trump can execute a policy of taking on what he calls China's economic aggression in a purposeful way, except as a sequence of actions, as the kind we're already familiar with, an investment agreement, we need an investment agreement, we need more respect for intellectual property, all the things that we've been talking about really in relation to China and the US for 20 years. So I'm sorry, I don't have an answer to your question.
All right, last question from me and then I'll go to the audience. Alex, what about public opinion on Mr. Trump? We've had results, I think, from Gallup and Pew about global public opinion on President Trump. How do they compare to Australian attitudes as revealed in your polling?
There were a couple of big US surveys released this year already, and they related to, you know, fieldwork and telephone calls that were made late last year. And Gallup, which takes a poll of over 130 countries at least once a year, found that global approval of US leadership had declined quite dramatically, by 10 points or more in 65 out of 130 countries. And the median approval rate dropped very significantly from 48% to 30%. So that puts it at the lowest level that it's been since they started asking this question in 2007. So the America First policy platform of the Trump administration, as well as perhaps the person of President Trump himself, has definitely not played out very well in the last year for American approval ratings. Well, then there's a question of how much does that actually count for? And then Pew asked a similar question, but in America. So this was really interesting. They ask Americans, how much do you think America is respected abroad? So it's sort of a self-respect issue. And that had also dropped quite significantly. So the number had risen who said that the US was respected less than it had been previously by around 8 or 10 points. But you have to look at the time frame here, because that result was reported as being dramatic and devastating as a report card for the Trump presidency. But in fact, that result had been achieved once in the Obama presidency and also in the Bush presidency. So it's not unprecedented. But in our own work, we have found in Lowy Institute polling over the last couple of years that approval of the Trump presidency is low, although what is holding up in Australia is support for the alliance, which is as high as it has almost ever been, and also warmth towards the United States generally. So for the moment, we haven't seen that sort of impact in Australia from the Trump presidency. But we have field work in March. The last time we asked these sort of questions was in March last year. So it will be very interesting to see what has happened in the years since and what sort of shift we've had in Australian attitudes and whether those sort of attitudes that Gallup has picked up will show up in our own polling of how Australia is responding to the Trump administration.
Great. All right. Who would like to ask some questions of the experts on the stage? Yes, I saw this gentleman first in the second row. Just wait for the microphone. If you could tell us your name and affiliation before you start and ask a short question, we'd be grateful.
Ian Enright, no affiliation. I was interested in your views about whether the proxy wars in the Middle East are likely to escalate or de-escalate, and in either case, their impact on the Asia-Pacific region.
I don't see any de-escalation. So you're talking about a few proxy wars, the main one being the one between Saudi Arabia and Iran that's being played out most directly in Yemen, but also a bit in Lebanon, a bit in Syria, although the Saudis seem to more or less accepted that Syria is a lost cause. But there are other kind of proxy wars for influence between Turkey, Qatar on the one hand, and the Saudis and other Sunni Arab countries on the other. It's throwing up some interesting alliances. So the relationship between Israel and Saudi Arabia, something a decade ago you couldn't, really have conceived of, is now kind of strengthening around this common common perception of a threat from Iran. So I don't see any of that diminishing, and it may well increase because, as I said, one of the things that American allies are very pleased about with the Trump administration is that whereas the Obama administration was as much softer on Iran, the Trump administration is much tougher. So in many ways, that's actually encouraging them to continue to push back against Iranian influence. In some cases, for example, the Americans have lifted arms embargoes that the Obama administration imposed on countries like Saudi Arabia over the war in Yemen. It's difficult to see how that impacts on our own region. The two interesting kind of dimensions are, one, the extent to which China becomes interested in playing a greater role in the Middle East. And that doesn't really affect us. It's kind of one way kind of connects the region. And there are some signs of that. The Chinese are certainly commercially very interested in the Middle East. They're very interested in the Middle East from an energy perspective. And they're also very interested, and they're starting to be a bit more interested in terms of arms sales to the region. But I don't see a dramatic change in that kind of coming soon. I think the Chinese are very happy to take a back seat behind the US in the region for the moment. The other way it potentially impacts on our region, though, of course, is in terms of the price of oil. And here it's quite what's been quite remarkable, not just the last year, but for the last couple of years, is the way that the price of oil seems to become disconnected with the region's crisis. It used to be, there was a premium, a risk, a kind of geopolitical risk premium that was there, pushing up oil prices in the past. There'd be some crisis in the region and oil prices would jump. There are now so many crises in the region that it's almost like the oil market has gotten a bit used to it. And at this stage, it's difficult to see any particular impact of the proxy wars on oil supply, on whether it would kind of cut supply from the region. So in that sense, I don't think it means too much for us.
On that issue of China's connections to the Middle East, but also to Central Asia, one issue that has attracted a lot of attention is the Belt and Road Initiative. And let me ask you, John, how do you think about the BRI. I mean, people talk about being $1 trillion of investment, I think, over the next decade. It's a very large number. Obviously, the Chinese are able to deploy state capital in a kind of organised way that a power like the United States doesn't. How big a deal do you see Belt and Road in both in economic terms, but also in terms of creating an ecosystem, a bit like the sort of Apple products ecosystem, where once you're in it, you're stuck in it because you don't want to get out and use another device? Could there be that kind of effect where it drags countries into China's orbit in terms of accepting Chinese standards, using Chinese technology, and generally pushing the balance of influence away from the West towards China?
Well, principally what it's doing is, you know, facilitating, is improving transport routes to China's West. And in the long term, it's got to be a good thing. They're not controlled by China necessarily. They're open to the users of the countries they pass through. I don't really see it as a difficulty. I mean, it's going to be a difficulty for China because the capital return on these huge investments is going to be very tiny and very distant. And it may well be that a subsequent generation of leaders rather regrets its largesse. But it's a great, you know, it's a very ambitious project. If it does indeed open up, reduce the cost of transport between, you know, right through Asia to Europe and the Middle East, that's got to be good.
I think Rob Thomas, did you have a question, Rob?
I suppose given the negative context which we seem to have at the moment of our politicians, I'd like to understand a couple of things. One, what are the positives at the moment? We live in a period of global stability on the whole, historically. And two, do you believe that yourselves and media commentators need to have more balance around issues rather than necessarily just focusing on the negative? You should be giving a bit more balance, that there is positives as well as negatives.
Bad news is good for business, Rob. who would like to have a go at that? Are we being too negative?
As it turns out, we'll be publishing a Low Institute paper in May of this year, which has a positive take on the Middle East, written by yours truly. And part of it was out of I wrote that over the last year, part of it largely out of frustration, and I'm generally a pretty pessimistic person, so it was quite an uncomfortable thing to write. But I also got sick of the kind of the prevailing view, there is nothing, you know, the future is invariably bleak, it's all bad, there's nothing that's good that's happening. Now, that's not to say that there aren't a lot of bad things happening in the Middle East. So what I said as the challenge was to try and scratch below the surface and find some of the good things. And so what the paper does is it identifies a few what I call green shoots. There are things happening domestically within countries below the surface, led by people themselves, that are actually quite positive and that could kind of transform the region in positive ways. Mainly because one of the reasons why these things can happen now is because the region is in such turmoil. The old system is so fragile and collapsing that things are able to grow through the cracks of the old system. So some of the, you know, to give you a little preview, one of the things I'd point to, the changing role of women in the region. One of the things we saw in the Arab uprisings were the prominence of female activists, not as activists for women, but just as activists. Many of the Arab uprisings had women in very prominent kind of leadership positions. There's also a really interesting economic driver here, which explains in part the reason why the Crown Prince in Saudi Arabia is letting women drive. There is enormous unfulfilled economic potential in women. They have some of the lowest employment rates in the world, but they have some of the highest education rates in the region, and generally women are outperforming men in university. The problem is when they finish university, rather than going into jobs, they're getting married, they're staying at home. So, and I think the Saudis understand and others understand that if you can tap into that enormous intellectual and labour potential, you know, you're talking about kind of massive increases in GDP, in economic growth, in wealth distribution.
Yeah, Ewan.
We live in a region, in contrast to the Middle East, that has been defined by almost uninterrupted peace between states for the last 30, 40 years. That's the good news side of living in this region where Australia is centred. Where I'm optimistic is we're not necessarily on a path to war between states. And that I'd include North Korea within that and China and the US, partly for the obvious reason that nuclear weapons play that deterrent role. Where I'm more pessimistic is it's precisely that desire to avoid conflict that forces states, I think, to make piecemeal concessions below the threshold of armed conflict that progressively undermines this rules-based order that we hear so much about. So that the value of that, I think, becomes progressively degraded, and we might find ourselves in a sort of drift towards a China-dominated sphere of influence that will also continue to pose very uncomfortable questions for Australia because of the nature of our inescapable geography. But that may occur without having to have the melodrama realised of an all-out clash.
Thank you. My name's Ian Kennedy. I have no affiliation. Thank you for the scenario you painted. My question is how would you care to comment on Australia's capacity and preparedness to respond politically, economically, and militarily, if needs be, to the scenarios that you've painted in these various areas?
Is there someone in particular you'd like to direct that towards? Me. Thank you very much. I wish I hadn't asked that question. One development that the Institute wrote quite a lot on at the end of last year in November, I think, was the new Australian foreign policy white paper. And that, taking the analytical starting point that things are heating up in our region, that the kind of order that we've become accustomed to for 75 years is cracking, that that one giant power, which happens to be run along Leninist lines, is having increased sway in the region, that the appropriate response for Australia is to step up. And the central metaphor, or the organising principle, I guess, of the foreign policy white paper was the rules-based order that Ewan mentioned. And it said that Australia has to step forward to help to try to buttress and support that rules-based order. And that, to me, makes perfect sense. I think Australia does have to do that. I think we have to have an assertive... we have to assert our interests and our values in the region. We can't keep taking these prices. We have to try to help to set them as well. And that means having, to go to a theme of Alex's work over many years, a strong, extensive diplomatic network. It means having a strong and capable military force. And it also means having a view about what we want to do in the world and how we want to shape things. I guess the reason, the caveat that I had, or the reservation I had about the foreign policy white paper and the prospects of that kind of policy for Australia, is that it's very ambitious for a country like Australia to do that. And in order to do it, you need a political system that is coherent. You need a government that is united, a government that has its mojo, that is winning election after election, that is carrying the country with it. And we haven't had that for 10 years. You know, for a decade, we have had prime ministers and governments who are clinging on from poll to poll. And I think most bookies would say that there's more than even chance that we'll have a change of government in the next 12 or 18 months. I don't say it's good or bad, but I simply say that in order for Australia, in order to see a step change in Australia's willingness to try to contribute to some of these issues, whether it's climate change on the one hand or reinforcing a rules-based order in Asia, so that the gains that Ewan talked about that we've all enjoyed over such a long period can be preserved. In order to do that, you need a strong, coherent political system. And I'm afraid it's been a long time since that has characterised our system. So that's my response. But would anybody else like to comment in your particular sphere about Australia's ability to take initiatives to address some of the problems you've identified? Ewan?
I think we're ill-prepared for the change in our region that's increasingly going to be set by a more antagonistic relationship between the United States and China. That's one resetting of the weather that seems to have become quite clear in Washington with the release of the National Security Strategy and National Defense Strategy, which frames the China and Russia relationship in those more clear adversarial Machiavellian terms. We've grown, I think, very complacent in a way about the choices that have to be made about security and viewing that through the prism of the alliance. The last 20 years, the strategic costs of having to pay the insurance premium on the alliance have been relatively low because those coalition deployments have been off in the Middle East, where Australia's strategic interests are mostly indirect. Now it's coming home to roost as our region becomes the centre of strategic gravity globally. And I think China knows that. I think they know that Australia is in an awkward spot economically, beholden to China on one level, but still clinging on the coattails of Uncle Sam for the security benefits of the alliance as far as possible. And I think that pressure is increasingly going to be purposefully felt. And we're beginning to see some of the discomfort, I think, in official reactions that we've seen. The foreign minister gave comments that appeared to deliberately distance Australia's threat perceptions on China from those of the US just in the last week.
The TPP Mark II, is it a sign that the US has reneged on its leadership in economic forums?
Philip Luker, no affiliation. I can any member of the panel say whether the US government allows China to buy land for farming in the US, as we allow, and Russia allows China to buy large areas of Western Russia.
Sorry, the question, so I understand it, the question on that is what?
And does the US government allow Chinese
agricultural land
to be sold to Chinese farmers in Russia, in America?
I see. Okay. Well, John, do you want to have a go at one or both of those?
Yes, I could. On the TPP, I guess I've always thought of the TPP as a sort of a model of a trade agreement, which is important as a model, but not as actually in its impact on the GDP of any of its adherents, signatories. Not very great, never pretended to be very great, because they're mostly open economies, because they all have a trading relationship with each other to the extent that they ever will. But it's useful on, you know, setting some new standards on services and investment and so forth. Does the fact that I presume the point of your question is, does the fact that the remaining members can go ahead without the US suggest that we can do without US leadership? I'd be very strongly in the view that the intent here is to keep this agreement alive until the US administration arrives that will adhere to it, and it has no other purpose, I would think. On this point about US land, I'm a little bit uncertain. I haven't heard of a restriction on buying US land. Personally, I think restrictions on buying land are ridiculous. You know, you can't take it with you. It has no kind of defence or security implication. Quite why Australian farmers and the National Party are so strongly upset about it, I'm not entirely clear, since it, you know, raises the price of land. But there you go.
Not everything is explicable, even by the Lowy Institute. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. Thank you to my colleagues on the panel. Yes, indeed. And let me just give a quick ad. Everybody on the panel has work that's either just come out or is about to come out, which I'd recommend to you. Ewan's next paper on North Korea will be out in the next couple of months, and he's the country's leading expert on security issues on the Korean Peninsula, so keep an eye out for that. Anthony, as he mentioned, the next Lowy Institute paper, our flagship publication published by Penguin Random House, will be out in May by Anthony, called Remaking the Middle East, which, as he mentioned, is on the green shoots of change that he sees but beneath the surface in the region. Alex is the author, of course, every year of the Lowy Institute poll. And the next, what's the date of release of the next poll? You mentioned that mid-June. We'll be going into the field in March, and the results will be out in mid-June. And finally, at the end of last year, John published a fantastic book, John Curtin's War, Volume 1, which contained all sorts of important archival findings. And I think Volume 2 is out later this year. Is that right, John? So if you enjoyed this, there's lots more to come that you can get your hands on. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us, and we look forward to seeing a lot more of you this year at Bligh Street. Thank you.